Hey, everybody. Oh, I think I'm coming in a little hot over there. Hey, everybody. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. Chat room, guys, let me know if my mic sounds a little hot to you. I think it might be a little bit. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show back here on the LRN network, where I never really left, but I have been live here on LRN in almost a couple of years now. Of course, Ian Freeman has been generous enough to continue playing the replays of my various other shows here on LRN all along. And I sure as hell appreciate that, and I sure appreciate him allowing me back. Very happy to be here. Am I on after Ernie? I didn't have time to tune in this morning. Is it Ernie on right before me? That'd be cool. Hey, Ernie's audience. Hey, New Hampshire. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Thanks very much for tuning in. My website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And I got my blog and my whole show archives and links to whatever you want on there. Articles I've written, etc. there. I even got a documentary section. Not that I have ever made a documentary, but just my collection of documentaries that other people made that I like. If you like things like that, go dig around, check it out, scotthorton.org. And you can sign up for the podcast feed, of course, for the interview archives or the whole show archives there at scotthorton.org if you want. And please, please, stop by scotthorton.org/chat and hang out in the chat room with the boys. I already got, the regulars have shown up. Many of them. And join up in there, hang out in the chat room, and maybe we'll get a little bit of a conversation going on and have a good time. The heroic Sheldon Richman, the most libertarian man in the world, I think. I mean, I don't know. Anthony Gregory, I think, is the most libertarian man in the world, but Anthony Gregory says that Sheldon is. So, what does that tell you? The silver standard's gold standard. Sheldon Richman will be on the show. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org and the editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom. And it's Memorial Day. I meant to say Happy Memorial Day or Mournful Memorial Day or whatever is most appropriate for you, to you. And today at the Future Freedom Foundation, they're running all articles about World War II. I'd urge you to go and check it out. I haven't had time to even get into it hardly at all, but in the morning email, which you should sign up for the FFF morning email, why not? FFF.org. But in the morning email this morning, it was all World War II. And Sheldon's article is from 1991. And there are two different articles by Jacob Hornberger. And then, in fact, here, let me go through this. Let me tell you a little bit about this. They pay me a little bit a month to advertise on the show. And so, okay, I'm compromised, conflict of interest style. Like, I wouldn't be sitting here telling you about the FFF anyway. So here is Hornberger has libertarian patriotism versus statist patriotism. And also the much coveted World War II. Sheldon has The Consequences of World War II, Robert Higgs, World War II and the Military-Industrial Congressional Complex. Richard M. Ebling has The Causes and Consequences of World War II, Part 1. Gregory Bresiger has The Road to the Permanent Warfare State, Part 1, by Justice Frank Murphy. This is one of the court cases, one of the war crimes cases from the end of the war there. Wendy McElroy, Framing the Great Debate on World War II. Anthony Gregory, previously mentioned, Was the Good War Unnecessary? And I believe that's his review of Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, which you might want to take a look at. Anthony's take on Pat's take on World War II. Very interesting stuff there. And then another one, even Dresden, Time to Say We're Sorry. I wish they had included Jacob Hornberger's 7-part series on Operation Keelhaul at FFF.org. Do you know about Operation Keelhaul? Where all of the Russian prisoners of war that had been held by the Germans that were liberated by the Western Allies, were repatriated back to Soviet communism and murdered, all of them. To surrender is a death penalty offense, you see. And so anyone who had surrendered to the Germans was considered a traitor. And about 3 million of them were murdered. And Harry Truman has just as much blood on his hands for that as Joe Stalin. It's absolutely incredible in the story. In fact, I've interviewed Jacob Hornberger about it. You can read the 7-part series at fff.org. I've interviewed Jacob about it before. I think we did a full hour on it or something like that. I got an agreement prior that, hey, we're going to really go through this, and this will be the greatest recorded audio version of this story that anybody's ever put together and that kind of thing. Let's do it. And we did. And, of course, Hornberger's great and is full to the brim with righteous indignation, which is just how I like him. So, Operation Keelhaul, man. And you know what Keelhaul means? That's where they throw you over the bow of the ship with a rope around your waist. And I guess, do they have ropes long enough? They go, you may be able to survive if you can come out the back end of the ship alive. What? I guess this is from the days before propellers. It sounds like it would be lethal each and every time, right? It's something like that. It means throwing your ass overboard and dragging you under the boat. That's what it means. Keelhaul. Quite apt. Too bad nobody ever keelhauled Harry Truman. So. There you go. That's my introduction. To Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show today. You like that? Yeah, it's going to be one of those shows. Also, you know what else is going to be on the show? There are these guys, Paul Gottinger and Ken Kippenstein, have written this thing. Maybe it's Stein. Damn, I should have asked him. I talked to the guy earlier. I should have said Steen or Stein. Paul Gottinger and Ken Kippenstein. Steen? Damn. They will be on the show to talk about this piece they did for Truth Out about American continued support for the dictatorship in Egypt, the coup d'etat military dictatorship in Egypt. And they've got a great scoop on that, and you won't be surprised, but you will be shocked. And you will not wonder why they hate us. I think it's funny that the new dictator's name is Sisi. What the hell kind of name for a dictator is that? I guess maybe it made him a real tough guy being named Sisi his whole life, you know? Field Marshal Sisi, as Eric Marley said, this guy's never fought a battle outside of his own office before in his life. But, you know, boy, he can whoop ass on some paperwork as good as any other field marshal in the entire Egyptian army. All right, anyway. A boy named Sue, number 6, says in the chat room. Exactly. Boy, that Field Marshal Sisi, he don't like it when you make fun of him, man. He don't like it at all. All right. Hey, you know what I need open here is the PDF file of the LRN clock. Here it is. You know what I meant to do is save this and then open it as a separate standalone little file here. My clock, it's different. My clock is different. All right. Also, we got tons of news. Other than World War II and Egypt, we've got obviously a huge, hugely important and consequential vote in Ukraine over the weekend. We have Obama's surprise visit to Afghanistan. Come on, guys. The Pope has gone and prayed at the separation wall. Not the Wailing Wall, but the prison wall. The giant West Bank concentration camp where millions of Palestinians live. And their giant ghetto there. That is huge. We're going to talk about that on the show today as well. And you know what? We got some breaks coming up. I'm running behind. The show's starting earlier than it has in a while. And I admit that I should be completely on the ball, and I'm not. There may be even more interviews than that coming up on the show. I'm still trying to get Jason Ditz to give us the latest. Oh, yeah, we got it. We've got Jason Ditz for later on in the show to come on and talk about the civil war breaking out in Libya. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, man. Yeah, so we're getting work done now. That's all I needed was some commercial break time to get some work done in. We've got Jason Ditz will be on to talk about the war cracking up in Libya. The civil war is still going on, I guess, getting worse. Woo, sounds like that thunderstorm. I don't even see light out my window. Hang on, I gotta go open the blinds and look at this storm, man. Sometimes I love a Texas storm, you know? Oh, yeah. Damn, blinds are broken. That's a good one. It's dark outside right now. It's not quite the same as living on the plains, but, you know, it can get really crazy. Yeah, we're gonna have to work on that mix there. A little technical problem with the motor head, I understand. All right. We're gonna work out our Lemmy problems. We're gonna make it work. We're gonna figure it out. All right, anyway, terrible thunderstorm. Sorry if there's a lot of background noise. I don't think it should be bleeding over into the microphone too much, but you can't stop Texas from storming when it decides it's gonna rain out here. But anyway, it'll be fine. So after Jason, then we'll also have Kelly Vlahos. And man, I'll tell you what, I mean, if you care about things, her article is going to piss you off, man. And, you know, it's funny because I think this Veterans Administration scandal is probably the first scandal that the right wing has come up with in the entire Obama years that's actually real, right? Everything horrible that he's done, that he's really done, Republicans support. So the only thing that they can attack him for is for being from Africa or some nonsense. Right? Some, you know, never mind the whole Libya war, just there wasn't enough security at Benghazi that one day. Or they're right about the IRS thing. The left wing's argument about the IRS thing is, nuh-uh, because they persecute, you know, outsider left groups too. Well, yeah, that's evil too. That's what's going on here. They're persecuting, the IRS is persecuting outsider groups, left or right. But so that's still a scandal, even though they kind of, for them to think that that's the most important thing out of all the people Obama's killed, an entire surge in Afghanistan that he knew would fail and did it anyway. I mean, man, that's the worst kind of betrayal. Never mind the technicalities of the treason statutes. That is a horrible leader right there. That is the worst scandal of all. And they don't care about that. They love that. What, murdering Afghans? Psh. That's why we're here, is to murder Afghans, don't you know, according to conservatism. So all they've ever had on Obama this whole time is a bunch of crap, and now somehow they have latched onto a scandal that's an actual scandal, this VA scandal. And when I first heard about it, I thought, oh my God, man, did you see this? Just like you could have expected, just like a libertarian would predict when they're really pissed off and they're telling you worst case scenario, this is what will happen if you let government control healthcare, this is what they're going to do to you. That was what was the original breaking story. Whistleblower. Blam. They have a secret list. were all their overflow patients. They just put them on this list where they pretend to schedule healthcare for them, but instead they are all just to go lay down and die. Well, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah. Well, Congress said that they better get faster. Well, they couldn't get faster, so they decided to just cover up the fact that they couldn't get faster by denying all these extra patients existed. Well, but then here's the part that I didn't really realize, just because I've been busy as hell and there's so much news going on, I can't keep up, man. I'm sorry. I'm trying. But I read Kelly Vlahos' article, and lo and behold, as soon as this broke all over the country, whistleblowers started coming out saying the same thing. And other horrible, different things, too. Finally, VA people all over the country tattletaling on their bosses, and I shouldn't put it that way, doing the right thing by telling the truth to the real bosses, supposedly the American people, about what their so-called servants are doing. And you know, in such an irreligious society as this, where the state is the higher power and everyone worships it, World War II veterans, they are the supreme idols. They are the icons. They are the greatest generation, the ones who sacrificed the most to do everything for us and all that. Sheldon Richman on to debunk all this in just a minute. But they are held up in American society as those, like if this was Japan or whatever, these are the guys we all bow to no matter what. They're the oldest, and they're the bravest, and they're the most honorable. And they destroyed the Nazis. I mean, really, the Soviets did. But they helped. And so we worship them. And yet to the VA, well, these guys are just baggage. And so sorry about your grandpa who heroically defeated the Nazis, but the government actually doesn't care about him at all. They just put him on a secret list. They just promise, oh, yeah, we're going to get you in and get you scanned and get you an appointment. But then they just never give him an appointment. They throw him in the garbage before he's even dead. I'm trying to get some of this off my chest before the interview so I can let her stick to the factual. I got a real problem with this. You know, I've tried to cover, and I haven't been good enough about it. But, you know, I talk over the years. I've been talking with Aaron Glantz, for example, Joshua Kors, some journalists who have done some really great work on the betrayal of the American soldiers by the government that lies to them and sends them off to war in the name of, and they really do believe this crap, and I don't know how they believe it. I mean, it's not even a convincing slogan. It falls apart if you think about it for just one moment, but they do believe, many of them, most of them, that they are fighting for freedom. That the only reason their government would send them to go and kill people and risk their own life killing people is because they absolutely have to. It's absolutely necessary to protect the freedom and the lives of the American people. That's what they believe. And then they go over there, and it's of course not true, but they go over there, they kill people, they see their best friends killed, they come home, you know, themselves maimed, whatever. And then the government's attitude is, screw you guys. They'll use any excuse to get out of giving them their health benefits. Oh, you know what your problem is? It's not that you've had 10 concussions from roadside bombs and that you've had to pick up all of your best friend's smallest body parts off of the ground all afternoon, 3 afternoons in a row or whatever the hell is driving you mad out of your mind. No, your problem is you have a personality disorder. And you know how personality disorders are. You must have always had it your whole life, which means you lied to us when you signed up for the Army and claimed you didn't have a personality disorder, which means you are now discharged and you are now no longer, what's the damn word? See, I could have wrapped that up tight if I hadn't have blown it. You are no longer eligible for your health care benefits, Mr. Personality Disorder. They pull that on hundreds of thousands of troops. They're still pulling that. And then I would always say to Aaron Glantz or Joshua Kors on stories like that, I would say it's unreal the way that they put our soldiers on such a pedestal that you can't criticize the policy, because to do so is to backstab and betray the lowest specialists and privates who are carrying out that policy. And so it's absolutely, you know, unacceptable for you to claim to know better than what the government is doing with these men in their lives. And then when they come home dead, the government throws them in the garbage. And then it came out they really were throwing their corpses in the garbage. Really, they were. My metaphor come to life in real life. The landfill. The dump. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Welcome back to the show, guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today, it's the heroic Sheldon Richmond. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation, and he's the editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom, which you can subscribe to at fff.org/subscribe. And it's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and highly worth it. And you get to help support a great libertarian institution that features the best writers in the libertarian universe. So that's at fff.org/subscribe. And yes, they do pay me a pittance to say that, but that's all right too, because it's no conflict, because as you well know, back when I was only paid by antiwar.com, and not much at that, I still interviewed Sheldon and the FFF guys all the time because, yeah, they're my boys. So there you go. And Wendy, too. I like her. Hey, welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Nice
okay, good. Appreciate you joining us today and appreciate you writing things for me to read, too. Let's talk about Keynes. I think it's sort of the premise of your article today that... at least there's plenty of reason for people to have plenty of problems with John Maynard Keynes and his economic prescriptions, I guess his diagnoses and prescriptions. And yet you're saying despite any problem that anybody has with him, everybody has got to concede that others really like this guy and they like believing in him. And so I guess that indicates that either there really is something to it, or there at least is really something to why people like believing in him, even though he's wrong. So, first of all, please describe, kind of thumbnail, about Keynesian economics, you know, the general theory, diagnosis, and prescription in a thumbnail. What might be wrong with it? I know you disagree. And then, you know, tell us why it is that people still like it all anyway, if it's so off base.
Well, Keynes... Keynes was a John Maynard Keynes, also Lord Keynes, was a very well known and eminent intellectual in Great Britain, even before the Great Depression. But when the Great Depression came along, he published a book in 1936 called The General Theory. Although in a funny way, he described his own book as not really a general theory, but as something addressing the times. And the times meant was you know, the depth of the Great Depression. 25% unemployment in the United States, a huge drop in production, and so there were, you had stagnation and not very good times, obviously. So he writes this book, which is trying to explain why there could be chronic unemployment in a market economy. You know, the previous economists, the classical school, the Austrian school, and others, you know, always talked in terms of an economy that could rejuvenate itself. If it got into trouble, it contained its own forces of correction, especially if the government got it into trouble by, you know, printing money and doing other things. If it was left alone, the market would regenerate itself. In other words, people acting. You know, the market doesn't act, only people act. So when I say the market rejuvenates itself, I mean that people taking appropriate responses to the problems going on around them, reshuffle resources and put them more in line with consumer demand, and therefore we can talk in terms of the economy fixing itself. So he proposed a way to end, you know, get economies out of their ruts, namely ending chronic mass unemployment. But he wasn't much concerned with what got the economy into the rut in the first place. When the Austrians would talk about that, Hayek was one of Keynes's main nemesis, probably the main nemesis. Hayek wanted to talk about what caused depressions, what caused the business cycle. Keynes wasn't interested in that. He said, let's just talk about what to do about it. You would think that how the economy got into the mess would give us some guide to how to get out of it. But he didn't believe that. He just thought, no, let's not talk about, you know, what might cause depressions. Let's just talk about getting out of depression. So he proposed, of course, printing money and government spending, because he thought the problem was insufficient demand in the economy for workers and for goods, and therefore that's why there was not much activity going on and why people were so badly, for long-term out of work for such a long time. However, as Larry White explains, my article really based on a chapter in a very good book by Larry White called The Clash of Economic Ideas, which goes over back the last 100 years of controversies in economics. And Larry's writing from an Austrian perspective. The problem with Keynes, the reason why it hung on was at the moment that Keynes was writing in 36, when things looked so bad, although things had been improving a little bit, they'd been turned down again in 37. There was a depression within the depression in 37. But the reason that it hung on was, according to Larry and according to other people, Milton Friedman and others, was Keynes seemed to give hope. He seemed to be saying we could do something right away to make things good by getting we can get people back to work by government spending and public works and printing money and stuff like that. And the Austrians, Hayek and others, were saying no, the market, the economy really has to cleanse itself of all the errors that were committed because government was printing money and holding interest rates artificially low in the 20s. You got to give it time to work things out. Well, this idea of you got to give it time seemed to be telling people, look, it's going to be a mess for a while, so just get used to it. While Keynes was saying, no, we can fix it right away. And even when the Austrians would say, wait a second, fixing it right away is going to set the stage for the next bust, they got poo-pooed, saying, go away. You're just naysayers. You're just gloom and doomers. We can do something today, and you guys are just standing in the way. And that's one reason why Keynes's ideas have held on for so long. Anytime there's a crisis, of course, politicians want to make things look good fast because, there may be an election coming up, or they don't want to lose support in the polls. So you can see the appeal of something, do something. We got to do something, and therefore anything qualifies because it's something, right?
In the Great Depression, you got people really starving to death. And so it's nice for some fancy guy in a fancy house and a fancy suit with a fridge full of food to talk about how we just have to, grin and bear it when he's not having to bear a damn thing. But of course, there's probably wasn't a single person who knew better than to do what they wanted to do, who wasn't in that position, right? So, if you got a belly full of nothing, you're eating dirt, and some millionaire is telling you that, oh no, if we try to feed you, that's gonna screw up the pricing system. You're gonna want to cut his throat and eat him.
Well, that's right. And look, economics is not simple. It's not intuitive, and average people don't pay attention to it. They don't. Most of them don't ever study it. The ones that study it don't remember anything after the final exam. Where they were taught bad Keynesian economics anyway. So most people aren't going to understand that. That's right. So the snake oil salesman in politics who has a court economist like, Keynes by his side can say, look, do you want to go with me who will do something right away? Or do you want to go with that guy who says, no, the economy's got to work out these errors, it's going to take time and, it's going to take the long run. That's why Keynes said it was in the previous book. But that's why Keynes made the famous statement, in the long run, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. It didn't so much mean that the long run doesn't matter and let's only look at the short run. That's not really what he was saying in that book, an earlier book on the Treatise on Money. He was saying we can't wait for the long run. He thought the classical economists and the Austrians were saying, look, things will work out in the long run. And he was saying, wait a second, a lot of us are going to be dead by the time the long run comes along. We can't wait for that. So, at the surface, Keynes seems to win. And I think that's why he did win. I think another thing that helped Keynes's case was that he gave intellectual cover for what the politicians wanted to do anyway, right? Which was borrow, spend, and print money. Right. So he gave them an intellectual aura. Hey, now look, this big shot economist in Britain says it's the right thing to do, that we do all these otherwise crazy things. Right. So I think that's one reason why it's popular to this day. Look, you can turn on Chris Matthews or any of these people on really any of the stations, and if you listen to some pundit give economic analysis, chances are it's going to be Keynesian. The government needs to spend. I mean, Chris Matthews every day is saying, why isn't the government building roads and putting people back to work by building, fixing bridges and all this stuff? And he once accused, more than once, has accused people who don't believe in Keynesian economics as not believing in science. He says, if you're anti-Keynes, you're just anti-science, which means you probably also don't believe there's man-made catastrophic global warming, and you probably also don't believe in evolution. He put all that together.
Somebody save us from Chris Matthews. Yeah. All right. Now, so here's the thing. Let me try to play devil's advocate here a little bit, which is that the reason there was a giant bust was because there had been a gigantic program of welfare for rich people in the 20s. This giant bubble wasn't a bubble for the little guy. It was a bubble for the rich guys. And then they busted it so bad, and then they screwed up everything, you know, with their giant tariffs and everything else. It was the rich and powerful who did all the things that caused the Depression that made it worse all along, and who had socialism for them since the days of Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Party. And, you know, the John Adams administration, come on, let's do some internal improvements, which means transfer money from the taxpayer to their friend, the banker, or their relation, the banker, more likely. And so it seems like, you know, obviously I just want to abolish the whole damn everything myself, but I can, I have a lot of sympathy for the argument that since we do live in a world where there is a USA, and since it always gave welfare to the rich, that by the 20th century, the poor kind of sort of had a point in saying, at least give us back some of our own money in the form of old age pensions, or maybe build us a highway or something that's going to benefit the rest of us, too, since you're stealing and printing money anyway. And now it's the break. But we'll be right back with Sheldon Richman and the possibility of good government spending right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Sheldon Richman. He's about as libertarian as hell, man. He's the vice president of Future Freedom Foundation. He's got this article today about why people want to keep believing in Keynes. So I'm doing my best to impersonate one of them. Hey, what about it? How about the idea, Sheldon, that the U.S. government has always been Keynesian in terms of military Keynesianism and in terms of stimulating bankers' pockets and, you know, railroad owners and this kind of thing. And so it's only fair for them to stimulate broader sectors of the economy and especially do things like build massive highway systems and useful bridges and dams and old age pensions for our grandparents so they don't all have to just lay down and die once they're too old to work and that kind of thing. So how about that?
Yeah, but if Keynes's proposals, which are based on a fallacious view of the economic process, are wrong, then they're wrong no matter what the objective is. So you can't pay back the people who have been unjustly treated by using the same kind of policies except directed at them. The whole problem with well, you know, as White explains in the chapter, Keynes basically threw out well over 100 years, almost 200 years worth of knowledge about how economies work. He basically said, well, economies don't work. There are no economic forces really that lead to coordination and general prosperity. That's why governments are going to usually be needed to help it along, because if demand falls, government's going to need to step in and be the spender of last resort. So he was wrong about that. So his solutions stemmed from fallacy, and so they're going to be wrong even if they're intended to help the masses rather than to help the privileged.
All right. Well, but then, so if it is taken as a given that whatever the excuse is, whether it's to try to, you know, whether they call it counter-cyclical stimulus spending to make up for the last boom and bust that they had caused or whatnot, still, what's the overall argument that it's that bad for the economy, for example, to have a Social Security program, which so many people love so damn much?
Well, Social Security isn't specific, distinctively Keynes. I mean, Social Security begins with Bismarck, Otto von Bismarck, in the late 19th century in Germany, as a way to keep workers loyal to the ruling party and to the emperor, rather than being tempted by either the liberal party or the Marxist party. So that's not distinctively Keynes. Keynes ultimately wanted a socialization of investment. He thought that that the government, which of course means economists hired by the government, maybe people like him, would be determining what where investment would be made. He thought ideally the interest rate should be zero so that the capital would be unlimited. But politicians, and like I said, and their economic advisors would be directing the capital. But that circumvents the market. The virtue of the free market is that entrepreneurs and others have to take their lead from consumer demand, which is reflected in prices. Mm-hmm. And prices do their work by channeling scarce resources and labor services to where consumers want it most. And also, part of what the consumer demand consists of is their time preference. In other words, the intensity of their wish for present goods over future goods. And there are times when people begin to save and put the money away, and like for instance in a bank or other forms of investment, which is then those resources that are then available for building up early stages of production, mining and research and development, and factories that are way down the line that won't produce consumer goods for some time. Keynes ignores all that, like the time structure of production, and acts like it's all simultaneous. He thought savings was a bad thing because he thought it wasn't being spent. If it's not being spent, firms, stores won't reorder, and therefore there'll be unemployment. He didn't seem to understand, although White shows that he earlier in his career understood that when people save, the money isn't just like stuffed in a mattress. That's not how people save. They would put it in the bank or in some other form of investment, which is then makes resources and labor available to earlier stages of production that won't yield consumer goods for a while. When people save, they're basically saying, I'm going to put off consuming. I'm going to save now so I can consume more in the future. That's why people save. They don't just do it out of animal spirits, which seems to be Keynes's view. Right. So it's a total.
Well, that's funny that he even denies or just ignores the fact that people are going to go to the loan and take out other people's savings and spend it on building up their new company, which is supposed to turn a profit and continue producing more wealth.
He was looking at things from the trough of the Depression. So he thought, well, why would anybody do that? There's already unemployed people and unemployed resources. Why is savings going to help that? But he didn't care to even investigate what caused that all that unemployment in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it was all the malinvestment that was brought about by the government artificially holding down interest rates as a favor to businesses, it's true, and creating money, which misshapes the economy. The economy no longer now is lined up with consumer demand. Because,
well, and by the way, back then, how much of a mystery was that really? Because, I guess the best I understand that is, as I've read it in Bob Higgs and the way he explained it, that especially starting in 27, they really started cranking up the money supply to help the Bank of England helped the English because Benjamin Strong and Montague Norman had such a close relationship, and basically Benjamin Strong was bailing out his friend at the Bank of England by debasing the American currency extra. But then, so that led directly to this giant stock market bubble and the crash and the crisis. And then, but was that really so opaque to Keynes and to everybody else at the time, other than Ludwig von Mises, or what?
Well, no, Hayek and others were warning about this, so it wasn't opaque. They just didn't see it as a problem. They didn't
even
see
after. Sort of like living through right now, when we're living on the other side of the 08 bus, and people still deny that the Austrians had any idea what they were talking about when they were warning all the time leading up to it.
Well, that's right. And the dominant opinion in 2008 was that this had nothing to do with government policy. This was all the result of selfish mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers.
And is it true too that, as David Stockman says, that the Great Depression was actually already over before Franklin Roosevelt was even sworn in? When you look at the stats, that the way all investment was going, et cetera.
I don't know if it's the case. I don't think it's the case that before he is sworn in, but there's certainly improvement by 36 or 37. But then the Fed does some things that put things back down again, like it increased reserve requirements, even though there were a lot of excess reserves, and it did some other things to cause the double dip. It was improving, but don't forget Hoover and the early years of Roosevelt were full of intervention. I mean, Hoover was jawboning companies not to drop wage rates, even though prices were falling like crazy, but they kept wages up, and that just created unemployment, mass unemployment. And then Roosevelt comes in and cartelizes the economy with the National Recovery Administration, and the Agricultural Adjustment Act. So there's intervention all over the place, which turned what might have been a quick recession. After all, the recession of 2021 was relatively quick. The government basically retrenched. It cut spending. It cut, I don't know if it cut taxes, but Hoover raised taxes. So they did everything to prevent a recovery. And yet, it's just to show you how powerful even the remnant of the market can be. There was improvement through the 30s until the Fed stepped in again and basically shrank the money supply, which then pushed everything over again. And then you also get the Smoot-Hawley tariff that was signed by Hoover in the 30s. You get all kinds of the market has all kinds of things being thrown at it, so it really didn't have a chance to recover. It's amazing that it recovered to the extent that it did.
Hmm. Yeah, I need to get David Stockman on. I haven't read the book. It's just vast. But one of the things I read in one of these articles, or I guess it was the transcript of a speech that he gave, was that if you look at these and those numbers, there was already vast improvement before FDR even finally got there. And then he immediately set about making everything worse. And I don't think he's a Rothbardian on Hoover, too. I don't think he was discounting the damage that Hoover had done, but he was saying, look, the recovery was already on anyway.
Well, people do things and try to create a recovery just by trying to scale down their businesses and make them more lean in bad times and those sort of things aid recovery. But the government kept throwing up obstacles. Unemployment was still quite high when Roosevelt was inaugurated. So I don't know how much of an improvement there was.
Hey, let me ask you this: you got more free time this afternoon?
Actually not. I got a bunch of things I have to get out before this day ends.
Oh, that's too bad. I was going to see if I could keep you one more segment. We could talk about the economics of intervention overseas, but I think I got a little rant of my own coming, so it'll be all right.
Okay.
But, all right, everybody. So that's Sheldon Richman. The article is at fff.org. The goal is freedom. That's TGIF. The goal is freedom every Friday at fff.org, and this one is called Immortal Keynes. Oh, say it ain't so. Thanks very much, Sheldon. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, great talking to you, Scott.
Appreciate it. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Now we're going to, I'm not sure yet, is this Paul or Ken here?
This is Ken.
Ken, oh, welcome to the show. How are you?
Paul's here as well. Paul, are you in here? Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, both of y'all are there. Okay, great. So everybody, Paul Gottinger and Ken, is it Kippenstein or Steen?
Kippenstein, like Frankenstein.
Okay, that was my guess, but who knows? I don't know. So Paul Gottinger and Ken Kippenstein, they have this thing in truthout.org, a very important piece here. It's called U.S. Continues to Surreptitiously Supply Arms to the Unelected Regime in Egypt. And they've got some docs and links right to them for you to look at here. Basically look like the receipts to me straight out of a Bill Hicks joke or something. But so maybe first of all, could one or the other of you just give us the very kind of nutshell version of 2011 through right now in the various regime changes over there in Egypt and what's led us up to this point, why it should even be a scandal that the U.S. is arming the Egyptians when, after all, we've been arming them since the days of Anwar Sadat.
Well, written into U.S. law is a rule wherein the U.S. is supposed to cut off military aid to regimes that initiate coup d'etats. And obviously, the Egyptian regime initiated coup d'etat when they overthrew their first elected leader, Mohamed Morsi. Keep in mind that this is the first formal election that Egypt has ever had. The U.S. smashed those hopes, the U.S. government. And what they ended up doing was actually supporting the dictatorship that is placed as of today because of the so-called election. And so just because they have that law in place that they have to cut off aid to a regime that undergoes a coup doesn't mean that they've ever respected that, but it does mean that it's in the rules. And so what John Kerry has to do right now, which is going to be very controversial, is he's going to have to state that Egypt is pursuing a democratic path, which is a bad joke, because they've labeled the Muslim Brotherhood, which got 51% of the vote in the last election, the new regime has labeled the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, and so they've imprisoned a bunch of people. They've sentenced 1,000 people to death. This is being condemned by all sorts of human rights organizations. And so once something like that happens, none of that dominant party is going to vote, obviously. I mean, that's completely obvious. And so anyone that's going to vote is just going to vote for the dictator.
Yeah, I mean, and the election is taking place today and tomorrow, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
And then do you have any information about there's one guy, I think, that was approved to run against Field Marshal Sisi here, right? Hamdine Sabahi. Can you tell us about him at all?
Well, the election is such a farce that even other former military brass from the Egyptian military are saying that, quote, the ballots are going to be rigged. Their whole thing's going to be a sham. This isn't even me saying this. These are the Egyptian generals themselves saying it.
And it's their sham. So were they bragging about it, or this
right.
is just some disaffected generals who would prefer to see some different puppets in charge?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's sort of partisan opportunism of the same sort that we see here in the U.S. Certain people shooting their mouths off because they'd rather be the dictator in charge, but what they happen to be saying corresponds with the truth.
Yeah. And now, so if this was a country that was not, America's pet and strategic interest for, the last generations going back like this, but it was just some other country and it was being backed by another major power in the world, say a so-called adversary like Russia or China, I think the Americans would probably have a lot different take on an elected government being overthrown by the military and 1,000-plus people being massacred in the streets, these, as you said, 1,000 people being sentenced to death with only, the most ridiculous modicum of a Star Chamber-type trial, all being, basically found guilty of association and that kind of thing. This would be absolutely huge. But to hear John Kerry tell, this is the restoration of democracy, saving it from the people who won
Yep.
the last election.
Yep. And he was one of the very few leaders to actually not label the overthrow of the elected leader Morsi a coup. It was a huge international controversy. Everyone's saying, come on, this is obviously a coup. You have even the Washington Post labeling it a coup. So basically you have, and the Washington Post is the most establishment beltway journalism that you could possibly imagine. And here we have the Secretary of State who refuses to agree with what even the establishment thinks.
And right, so, even Robert Kagan has split with Bill Kristol on this.
Right, right.
I mean, that's a big deal, because
exactly
he's
right.
saying, hey, in our doctrine, democracy, are you sure we want to completely discredit ourselves forever by taking the dictator side here?
Right. And I think you're exactly right when you point out to the hypocrisy of the U.S. Federal government, because, I mean, look at the glaring condemnations of when Russia occupied Crimea. And in terms of deaths, it doesn't even come close to what the Egyptian regime has done. And so, they label this aggression and all these different things, which, I mean, I think there's something to all of that. But you lose your credibility when you say that, and then you refuse to call a spade a spade. You refuse to label a coup when it happens in one of your own client states.
Yeah.
And so this is something governments always – you condemn the crimes of enemies, and you ignore the ones that you have the most control over. So I'm sure that in Russia – there's not a whole lot of criticism going around about their occupation of Crimea, the same way there's not a whole lot of criticism going around about the crucial U.S. aid support to the Egyptian military junta.
Right. Well, even an honest, objective accounting of that, you'd be hard-pressed to find 1,000 dead Crimeans, at this
right.
point
yeah.
anyway. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe the Tatars will rise up or something and be crushed. I don't know, but... certainly nothing compared to the brutality of the coup, but it is, of course. Will Grigg on this show is always paraphrasing Vladimir Lenin about, it's all about who does what to who. It's not about the what, it's all about the who. And so military
right.
coup d'etat for American interests, that is democracy. That's what democracy means, what we said. doing as told
yep,
by
exactly.
our government.
If it's a coup we like, then it's not a coup. That's democracy.
Right.
And so if you actually look at what John Kerry said, this is the most – I mean, you couldn't find this in Orwell. When the military coup was underway in Egypt, Kerry actually said that the coup was, quote, restoring democracy. That was a direct quote.
Right. But here in a moment, we're going to have to take this break. But we'll be right back, everybody, with Paul Gottinger and Ken Kippenstein. They've written this really important piece for truthout.org. U.S. continues to surreptitiously supply arms to the unelected regime in Egypt. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's Memorial Day. Talking with Ken Kippenstein. I guess we've lost Paul. Paul Gottinger, his co-author here. But Ken Kippenstein we have on the phone. He's from truthout.org. And they wrote this article, U.S. continues to surreptitiously supply arms to the unelected coup d'etat regime in Egypt. So please take us through some of the numbers here. First of all, you've already established that the law says that if America's government gives foreign aid to a government and then they have a military coup d'etat or whatever kind of coup d'etat, overthrowing an elected government, then the U.S. government won't give them aid anymore. And in violation of that, they have been doing what exactly? Giving what exactly?
So in October, after a lot of the human rights violations were coming to the fore from the unelected military regime, the State Department said that they were going to withhold, M1 Abram tanks, F-16 fighter jets, and Apaches. These were all explicitly said to be suspended from a State Department cable in October. And so we looked at the weapons invoices. In industry parlance, it's called bills of lading. And so what we determined from these was that the U.S. has, in fact, sent $44 million worth of guided missiles, $25 million worth of armored fighting vehicles. This includes the cannons and gun mounts for the M1 Abrams tanks that were explicitly suspended. And then we gave they gave $5 million worth of parts for Apache helicopters and F-16 fighter jets parts, which also is in violation of the arms freeze. And what's particularly amazing here is how narrow the arms freeze was. If you really want to stop Egyptian human rights violations, you want to target what are called crowd suppressants, what are used specifically against protesters, things like tear gas, pepper spray, those kinds of things. And the U.S. made no statement of freezing any of those. But what's particularly amazing is even the things that they did say, the narrow things that they did say they were going to freeze, tanks, F-16s, Apaches, they didn't end up freezing those. About a month or two later, they even ended up reversing their statement on the Apache helicopter so they could continue to send those out.
And, you know, I saw the magic word Lockheed in here, and, I don't know if it even matters at this point whether Israel is the country next door or not. Lockheed has got some product they need to get rid of, and that's what Uncle Sam exists for. Sure does.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, if you look at these weapons contracts, these are $7 million in Hawk Surface of Terror missiles coming from Aerojet Rocketdyne, and then $7 million coming from Lockheed Martin, and then $400,000 for Boeing. This is big business for these companies. And so at a time, at perhaps the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, we're continuing to spend tens of millions of dollars on a regime that is specifically prosecuting some of the worst human rights violations, and this is according to fairly conservative human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We're trying to dig ourselves out of the hole, and we're spending tens of millions on a totally abusive regime.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the thing is, too, if they meant what they said at all about, like, hey, you know, we need some, you know, a reformation in modern Islam, and we need, you know, free markets and democracy for the Middle East and all that, like in the hype that they push, pretending to back the Arab Spring that they opposed and all that kind of thing. But if they meant what they said, then the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood won the election, the elections, the parliament and the presidency, it seems to me they would see that as a good thing. This would be the number one greatest incentive ever for them to cool out. And, you know, it's not a guarantee necessarily, but if they have a real, and especially if they're kind of divided with the, you know, more so-called secularist types and whatever in a democratic framework, then they got to move toward the center. And you know, maybe their Islamism, could be implemented in a way that is less threatening to those who would oppose them, and then maybe turn on them and side with the military against them, like is what happened, but the Americans, you know, could have encouraged this and saw this as a really good thing and encouraged the military that they own lock, stock, and barrel to back off here for a minute. Egyptian society actually has a chance. It's not that democracy is a panacea for everything. Hell, sometimes it leads right to civil war. But, it could be the start of something good there in the most important Arab country, the trendsetter and doctrine center for the whole region. But they don't believe in their own so-called New World Order at all. They just as soon have a military dictator that'll do exactly what he's told and keep the people of Egypt in the darkest of dark ages and with inflationary currency destroying their ability to even feed their families on the basic level and this kind of thing. From now on, they don't care about any of the things that they pretend to care about, that they invoke as their excuses for their intervention over there.
I completely agree, and further evidence of the fact that they don't care about the, you know, high-flown ideals of democracy that you can hear Obama and John Kerry always holding forth about. Further proof of that is the fact that in the October weapons-free statement, they made those remarks to the New York Times and to Reuters picked it up, and if you look at the remarks they made them all off the record. Well, there's a reason for that, because they knew they were lying through their teeth. Someone doesn't want to go on the record when they say that if they know that it's soon going to be contradicted. And so the New York Times obediently ran the story off the record without specific citations and not asking why they want it to be off the record, because that's what the establishment press does. And then, well, a couple months later, we found that they contradicted what they said, and that's why they wanted to remain on deep background when they said it.
Yep. Boy, it really goes to show the cynicism of the regime change in Libya, which was mostly nothing but a publicity stunt, because they came out looking so bad for backing Mubarak till the bitter end, and then trying to get Omar Suleiman, the head of the secret torture police, to replace him, that they realized belatedly that, man, they came out looking really like the bad guy in the Egypt thing, so let's go ahead and overthrow expendable Gaddafi in the name of taking the side of the little guy here. And, you know, never mind all the consequences from what they did in Libya. But it just goes to show that it's not even plausible that they learned a lesson from Egypt, that they really better take the right side in the Arab Spring. No, they didn't mean that at all. It was simply a publicity stunt. They're perfectly happy to go back to backing the next Mubarak. Since Mubarak Jr. wasn't up for the task, they found Field Marshal Sisi to be the new dictator instead.
Exactly. And they're happy with Mubarak. I don't know if you saw in the news very recently, but Mubarak got a prison sentence, and it kind of shows what the beliefs of the new military regime are. His prison sentence was something like 3 years, so they obviously don't take these horrible human rights violations seriously. I mean, that's a slap on the wrist compared to what he should have gotten, you know. And he's probably not going to serve half of it. They might even let him out because he's so old. And in addition to that, you brought up Libya. If you look at Libya, Gaddafi, he was a horrible monster. But you look at the state now, it's practically a failed state, just like Iraq. There are different factions. There's different extremist factions vying for power. They don't even know who's in charge. They try to export. The U.S. tries to import oil from them. They can't even get it out of the state because there's so many different terror factions trying to fight for the oil.
Thank you very much for your time. We have a whole other interview coming up about Libya and the whole civil war going on there here in just a few minutes. But I really appreciate having you on here. It's a great piece, and tell your co-author, Paul, thank you very much for us. The piece is U.S. continues to surreptitiously supply arms to unelected regime in Egypt at truthout.org by Paul Gottinger and Ken Klippenstein. Thanks again. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's Memorial Day 2014. And, well, it doesn't matter that I'm on the air. I couldn't be out in this weather anyway. I got a Texas storm outside the window there. My dog is terrified. But anyway, I hope the weather's nice and you guys are having a nice time wherever you are today. Thanks for joining us on the show on a holiday here to mark this Memorial Day. Perfect timing, really, here. We've got the great Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com on her great new article, terrible new article, Memorial Day Nightmare. As scandal sweeps the VA, real reform will come from institutional transformation, not more number games. Again, that's Kelly Vlahos at theamericanconservative.com. And I think this one will be running in the print issue. And you can find the link today at antiwar.com in the viewpoints and in the top news section today. And this is a really important and a very well done article. And I really hope that you'll look at it. Pass it around, especially show it to right-wing warmonger-type friends of yours because it's in the American Conservative and everything. And so maybe they want to spin this as just an Obama crisis, but that'd be okay too. You know, why not? I don't know. Welcome to the show, Kelly. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today and especially taking time out and bearing with me as I screw up all the time zones and everything here. But this article is such an important piece of work here. And honestly, I saw when the story first broke and then I had missed the developments. But I guess just catch us up on the facts of the case here, if you could, please.
Sure. Well, it all started. CNN had done an investigative piece in late April about the Phoenix VA system, in which they alleged that there were 40 veterans who had died waiting for care, and that there were upwards of 1,600 patients there who have been waiting for care. They interviewed family members who had said that they had issues. Their veteran had issues ranging from, you know, early stages of cancer, very serious breathing issues, heart problems, who could not get an appointment for months on end. They found that these patients had been put on what we're calling a secret waiting list, in which their long wait times were not showing up on the system's electronic records. So what happened was until there was an appointment for these veterans, they didn't show up on the official system or network that, you know, that are being watched by their federal overseers. So by all official standards, it looked like Phoenix was just pushing veterans through on time within 14-day windows, which is the guidance that President Obama had initiated a year or two ago when the backlog schedule the scandal erupted. Well, what they were doing was taking all of these poor veterans and putting them off the books, so to speak, just to make their own books look better. And it turned out they weren't the only hospital that was doing this.
All right, now wait a minute. Let me stop you there for just a second before we get to the further developments from there. But I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
I think, did I understand it was implicit in what you said, that they were getting appointments, but they weren't getting put into the system until appointment day or something like that, and that was how they were skewing the numbers?
Yeah, so until the appointments they would come available within a 14-day window, then their names and their requests for care were put into this public system. I mean, public meaning this was the system that, you know, was accessed by all administrators. This was the system that they showed Washington to prove that they were working in successfully on the backlog. Mm-hmm. But until that point, they were sort of put off the books. Right. So you have these veterans who have been waiting for months for care on these quote unquote secret lists.
But so then anybody on the secret list, they're waiting longer than they would be if they had to admit that these people existed up until the point that they can finally get them in. Is that it?
Yeah, well, I just think that they had such a backlog. And in the Phoenix case, they said there were 1,600 veterans that had been waiting for care. So there was such a backlog. That in fear of being called out or being penalized by the inspector general or the federal oversight, you know, that was in charge of keeping these backlogs in check, they just took it off the books. I don't know if it caused, you know, more veterans to more wait time.
Well, you mentioned Thomas Breen in here. He waited more than 2 months for an appointment, right. And then it turned out that, he died of stage 4 metastasized cancer. Maybe they wouldn't have been able to treat him at all, but we'll never know because where else in America does anyone ever have to wait for 2 months for an appointment?
Yeah. It's absolutely abhorrent. It's just outrageous. I know that they've, you know, the Phoenix system has been pretty adamant that they were taking care of veterans in a timely fashion and that they wouldn't let these veterans die and that they are conducting their own investigation. And I think that they found so far that 17 veterans have died, but they won't say whether it was connected to their wait times or not. The VA itself has done its own investigation over across all of its systems and found that 23 veterans that were on wait lists had died over the last year. So I don't have the study right, you know, in front of me. But, you know, what I believe here, in because of the subsequent reports, finding that at least I think it's 8 or 9 other systems have whistleblowers have come forward to say, yes, we have secret lists going on in our system. I believe that the VA has been aware that this has been going on. And I believe it's probably a much bigger scandal or problem than we're even getting a hint of at this point. I think at this juncture, it's a matter of the whistleblowers coming forward and saying this is happening at my VA.
And now how many different whistleblowers do we have at this point? Because as you said, this story only broke, a month ago?
Yeah, it only broke a month ago. Yeah, and I would say in total there are 9 systems that we're dealing with here, 9 facilities.
Is that 9 different whistleblowers or a few less than that?
Yeah, I don't know if it's 9 different whistleblowers, but you have whistleblowers in each of these states.
Mm-hmm.
So that came forward, and some of them said, you know, we already had an investigation going on in my system. It's just that it had been very quiet. And so it turns out that this secret list issue is not new. And we even have a memo that indicates that the feds in Washington at the VA there already knew in 2010 that there was a secret list problem going on. So it kind of lays bare this assertion by former General Shinseki that this is Phoenix was an isolated incident. It's clearly not an isolated incident. But this tells me, and which should for all your listeners, is that, you know, under the pressure of trying to get this, you know, 1 million backlog down, these systems have put a hell of a lot of more energy into covering up the fact that they're not caring for veterans at an efficient pace than they are for caring for the veterans. And I don't want to disparage everyone that works at VAs because I know that there are many, many good doctors and officials at these places, at these facilities that are really earnest and trying to do the right thing. But I think the pressure to get these backlogs down have caused people to try to take obvious shortcuts to save their fannies. And now they've been caught. And
now I'm sorry, we got to hold it right there and take this break, Kelly. But we'll be right back, everybody, with the great Kelly Vlahos from the AmericanConservative.com Memorial Day Nightmare on the VA scandal.
the military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here, man. I am breaks along. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, and I'm so lucky I got Kelly Vallejos on the phone. She's got this great article for Memorial Day. I'll tell you what, it is a nightmare. Memorial Day nightmare at theamericanconservative.com. You can find it in the top news section and in the viewpoint section today at antiwar.com. Do your part to make this thing viral over there on Facebook and Twitter and what have you, would you? This is really important, what's going on here. So many different lessons to be learned, but it seems to me the most glaring thing here, and this is sort of just my imagination in a way, right? But it sounds to me, Kelly, like just the ultimate Milgram experiment here, or one of those weirdo things where you try out just what evil you can get people to do under the color of authority. You know, give them a white lab coat, give them a little shiny costume jewelry for their lapel, and then all of a sudden, they can order you to do any horrible things. So think of all the, I don't know, the little old ladies, the proverbial little old ladies that work at the VA who give each other knowing looks about, geez, what a horrible thing we're in the middle of doing right now, as they keep doing it all across the country, putting them on a secret list when any one of them knows it's wrong. And none of them will go ahead and speak up until, I guess, I'm happy to say, as you report here, after one spoke up, a lot of people started coming forward about this. But just how could it have gotten to this point? The incentives for the people who show up every day and allow this to go on without calling James Risen or Kelly Vallejos, it's just, it ain't right, man. How does this happen? We're talking about every single one of these people is a grown adult over 18, most of them with advanced degrees here, these doctors and things like this, right? I mean, yeah. It's madness.
Well, I mean, this has been going on for 10 years. I mean, in the whole idea of these backlogs, we started hearing about them as early as 2007. So the backlogs have been growing and growing and growing. And this is one of the things that happens when you send 2 million men and women into war for 10 years. They're going to come home and they're going to start accessing these services almost immediately. So you have about a million veterans who are now accessing or have filed claims to access Veterans Administration services. So you have this huge deluge of veterans coming into the system, and you don't have the capacity to take care of it. And even though the VA had been warned, as far back as 2001, when they started sending troops to Afghanistan, they did not prepare adequately. Why? Because it is a massive bureaucracy that had already been riddled with failure and corruption for years, dating back to Vietnam days, and they never fixed themselves. And so when you have a sick bureaucracy, that's rotting from the inside. And, I'm talking about, the issues of bloat, of cover your ass, of, little fiefdoms going on, all of the issues that go with these, Byzantine labyrinths of bureaucracy. When the rubber hits the road, so to speak, they're not capable of taking care of their chief customer, which is the veteran.
Well, and part of that, too, is the meta lie of the entire terror war is this is going to be easy. We're the baddest badasses ever, and these guys are cavemen, and come on, guys, let's go kill them all and this and that. But no, it turns out it's actually horrible for the people who are killing them all, because the all is a bunch of civilian residents of Kandahar, people who don't deserve killing at all. they come back feeling so guilty they want to blow their own brains out over what they let their government convince them to do.
Well, and you brought up a good point, because politically, this bureaucracy was incapable of marshaling all of its resources, because American people were told that we weren't going to be seeing a lot of casualties. You know, so there was never a real prudent marshaling of the resources to prepare for massive casualties coming in for multi-trauma like we've been seeing, for the PTSD that we're seeing, because politically, you know, they had to put on a happy face. So there's a lot of the politics. We're seeing the outgrowth of the politics that were going on 10 years ago. But, you know, to get back, so you have 10 years of backlog, and now these administrators at these facilities are being told by Washington, you need to clear up this backlog now, because we need to save face, you know, to Congress and the American people. And they're finding, well, they can't do it as fast as they're expected to. And all of a sudden they go into CYA mode. You know, I gotta save my job. I gotta, you know, and they'll do anything to save their job. And I think that's what you're seeing now. But, you know, until CNN broke the story, it was like, you know, the mainstream media had only been nibbling at the edges of this veterans crisis.
Right.
And it just goes to show you, you know, when a mainstream corporate news organization comes in and says 40 people have died waiting for care, then all of a sudden, all of Congress is paying attention, all of the mass media is paying attention, you know, the president is paying attention. They're calling for Shinseki to step down. But good journalists and people have been doing these stories for, you know, several years now about the care at the VA. And, you know, I'm happy that CNN broke the story and that finally it's getting the attention it's due. But to say this is a crisis that came out of nowhere would be, you know, really stupid and remiss, because it's been going on. And it goes much further than wait lists, as you know. There's a lot of things going on.
It's the denial of the injuries more than anything.
The denial of the injuries. You know, there's this case.
Loopholes.
This case in St. Louis that the Center for Investigative Journalism did, in which they have, you know, mental health counselors actually doing the very minimum in terms of seeing patients every day. And this whistleblower couldn't take it anymore. And he said, listen, we have all these mental health counselors here. We have all these psychiatrists here.
What is it? Because when you're talking about psychiatrists who work at the VA, they're getting paid. They're showing up in the morning. And these are serious professional people to be an actual credentialed psychiatrist. So it can't be that they just don't care to do their job there. There has to be, in fact, like a negative incentive that makes them need to lean the other way rather than working overtime. In fact, just sit and twiddle their thumbs. What is going on?
You know, I don't know. And that's my short answer. I mean,
you know, the problem is it's so easy to imagine being in these people's same position. Give me Eric Shinseki's job. And of course, the first order of business for all of my little right hand men, Smithers, whose job it is to carry out my will, is to go and turn every part of this thing upside down, map out who's everybody's enemies, who's doing what wrong thing, audit the hell out of all of the books and all of the numbers, and figure out what's really going on here, and make sure, if only because of how stuck up I am, that I don't end up getting nailed to the wall for some World War II vet dying on a secret list out there somewhere. That, you know what I mean? Like, even if I was Shinseki, if I wasn't me, but I was him, why wouldn't I do everything I could to prevent this kind of thing from happening to me? You know? I just don't understand it. It's like they don't care at all. But why not?
Yeah.
It's like they got a printing press. It's not like they can't afford it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we're just lucky that there are whistleblowers like in that St. Louis case. You know, he came forward. He said, listen, I was demoted when I came forward to my direct superiors and said, you know, my fellow doctors are doing the minimal in terms of helping these vets who are suffering from psychological problems. And he got demoted. So he went to the press. And now, you know, now there's a huge investigation in St. Louis, which, of course, you know, officials deny. his charges. But I think that we are lucky that there are people in each of these systems who are willing to risk their careers. And you and I have talked about this before. Mm-hmm. And I know that the Project for Government Oversight has teamed up with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And they've basically developed a web page, and they've invited, you know, whistleblowers to come in. They promised to give them cover. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of, you know, legal people who are ready to take whistleblowers under their wing. So maybe because we're in a new era now, that whistleblowing is being more, is more of a protected and respected, you know, way of getting the public, you know, scrutiny on these issues. You know, maybe this is the start of something bigger. I don't know, Scott. I mean, I believe that the more brave people that will come forward, the more that Washington will be forced to take action. Like, Shinseki will have to fire people at this point.
Right. And maybe himself. I sure hope so. Thank you so much for your great journalism and your time, as always. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
That's the great Kelly Vlahos, everybody. Memorial Day nightmare about the VA scandal at theamericanconservative.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the dang old show. I'm Scott Horton. And boy, I must lose a lot because I keep getting more and more Twitter followers, but my number never seems to go up. Well, I can be kind of offensive sometimes, I suppose. Well, anyway, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Scott Horton Show. And honestly, I had such a surreal day yesterday. I told the wife, I said, wife, you're not going to believe this, man. I am in a Twitter war with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher about who's a traitor. And I'm calling him a traitor for being guilty of the felony of material support for an anti-American international terrorist group that Mujahideen call communist terrorist cult. And, he's accusing me of working for the mullahs. Oh, you're working for the mullahs. Otherwise, why wouldn't you be down for the Mujahideen cult, communist terrorist cult, that used to work for the Ayatollah Khomeini before, I don't know who betrayed who, and he kicked their sorry asses out, and then they went to go work for Saddam Hussein and helped him with the crushing of the Shia and Kurdish uprising in 1991, the great Babe Pigs in the Desert, when George H.W. Bush urged the people, the Shiites, and Kurds, to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein, and then actually help Saddam Hussein. Didn't just let him keep his helicopters, landed their own helicopters on the highway to prevent the army division that was marching on Baghdad from succeeding in their mission. Absolute horror show. And the Mujahideen cult, there was the great quote, right, of their leader, and it really is a cult like Bowen T, Heaven's Gate cult of this husband and wife, although the husband is probably dead. He's been missing for a long, long time now. But anyway, the wife said, you know, was it let the Kurds feel the treads of your tanks or whatever? Some kind of ruthless kill them all sort of sloganeering, as they did exactly that, crush the Kurdish rebellion then back in 91. And then they, after the regime change in 2003, they went to work for Donald Rumsfeld, as my wife reported, Larissa Alexandrovna, in rawstory.com. You can read about how Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were using the Mujahideen cult as anti-Iranian terrorists. Actually, I guess in her reporting, they're doing intelligence missions and perhaps attacks, but I don't think she reported attacks. It was others that reported attacks. Scott Ritter reported MEK attacks in Iran. I don't believe Larissa actually ever reported attacks, but there are others who certainly did, including it was Barack Obama's White House, as you well remember, right, 2 years ago, when the Israelis were really getting out of hand on the Let's Attack Iran issue, and the administration pushed back with important articles in the New York Times saying the CIA still doesn't believe that there's a nuclear weapons program or threat going on here, and so everybody cooled their jets, which was huge because they kicked Sanger out of the way and let James Risen write it, which was seemed pretty important, and they told the truth there. And then also, they put a story in Foreign Policy about how Israelis posed as American CIA in order to recruit Jandallah, bin Ladenite type terrorists in Iran, which would have been what, 08 through at least 09, 010, something like that. And then they put another, again, very authorized, very top-down leak in NBC News about how the MEK, in this case, they weren't accusing him of working for Cheney Rumsfeld. They were accusing him of working for the Israelis doing the assassinations inside Iran. And quite credibly, I think. The Israelis later said that, these were Israeli Jews who had somehow, you know, become secret agents on the ground inside Iran and done it. But I don't think that's very likely. I think it's probably more likely that MEK types did it. But anyway, you can also go back, and I hasten to mention that you can listen to my interviews of a young scholar named Jeremiah Goulka, G-O-U-L-K-A. He's sort of a former centrist fiscal conservative liberal Republican type from the Northeast type, although I think he's from Illinois, Chicago, but he's kind of a Rockefeller Republican turned Democrat because of just how bad conservatives got. That's kind of his political thing. So very centrist sort of a guy, very normal and acceptable to all you normals out there. And he worked for the Rand Corporation. He helped them write a study all about the MEK and how they live at Camp Ashraf, and I think they've now been moved to Camp Liberty in Iraq. But anyway, they're a hardcore cult. I mean, you're talking about families separated from each other, children basically kidnapped from the earliest ages and sent all over the world, away, kept away from their parents, always, you know, threatened that. Imagine living like that. Somebody holding your kid hostage from now on. Basically, where adults, they have to raise their hand in order to speak, in order to go to the bathroom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're crazies. These people are absolute Jim Jones, Heaven's Gate, Charlie Manson, cultist lunatics. And they claim they're no longer commies, but they were commies. And they call themselves the Mujahideen, which you would think would be kind of out of favor right now. They're the people's Mujahideen. Isn't that funny? Marxist Islamists. You guys probably need to go back and actually reread Marx. Maybe you read a censored version in your native language that didn't include all the parts about how there's no God. But anyway. These MEK kooks. And I actually got in a big fight with Dana Rohrabacher about this on Twitter. And now everybody's piling on. And even his friends are saying, Dana, dude, stop it. You're just doubling down in your... What are you doing? How did this happen? And anyway, what sucks is he's not the very worst Republican. He used to be a libertarian before he came a conservative and, you know, as repudiate. He's a warmonger and pretty bad. On the other hand, not only is he good on pot, but he actually has been really good at trying very hard to talk other conservative politicians into going ahead and stopping being bad on pot. No, 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 this really is wrong, and here's why you need to understand, and he's a bit evangelical about it, and he's damn right, and it really is, you know, it sounds like kind of a trifling little thing, you know, it's just weed, but the consequences for people from the war against it are just out of control. You know, to take that stand is immensely important, and he's going to go down in history, actually, as having such a positive effect, because you need right-wingers. It's no good to know that hippies want to be able to smoke a joint and not get in trouble. What's important is for conservative Christianist types to say, nah, it's okay, let the hippie be. It's better than having a war against it. Go ahead and let him be. That's what's important, the conservatives leading the charge on that. And he is an individual, kind of a free-thinking guy. He's not a lockstep Republican. He's got major problems. I'm sitting here. He's calling me a traitor, so it ain't like I'm that bad of an apologist for him. I guess I don't take him seriously enough to really have my feelings hurt or anything. But, you know, I don't know. He's kind of a mixed bag. I think it's too bad that he's taken this horrible position in favor of the Mujahideen caucus. And right as I sure hope, and I know I don't mean to be naive, guys, but I want so badly for them to get this nuclear deal with Iran, not because I favor the mullahs or any politician in Iran or anywhere in the world. I don't favor any political system other than liberty. But what I do favor is the lives of and the rights, the natural individual rights of the people of Iran to not be bombed and to not be strangulated economically by the United States of America. More importantly, I'm for the principle that my government has no authority to do any of those things, to insist this, that, or the other thing about how Iran behaves. It's really none of my business. And I think that after Dana Rohrabacher and all of his colleagues and compadres spent the last decade, as he admits, although he doesn't take personal responsibility, doing the Ayatollah's dirty work in promoting regime change against Saddam Hussein. Oh, you never heard of the idea that Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollahs were enemies before, huh? Oh, I wonder, weren't you the same guy who, one of the same guys who supported Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan's support for Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran? You didn't think that they might benefit when the majority of the people of Iraq are Shiite Arabs and all their highest ranking religious authorities in the world are Iranians? Anyway, after a decade of doing the Ayatollah's dirty work, I think maybe Dana Rohrabacher and his colleagues ought to shut the hell up about their unique evil, especially when we're on the eve of possible peace and the end of our Cold War against them. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check me out at scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. Say hi to everybody in there. It's a Memorial Day celebration. Hope y'all have a good day. Hope the weather's nice wherever you are. Jason Ditz is coming up on the show. We're going to talk about Libya. Thank goodness for that. Stay tuned for that. I want to say I like this FPP Radio News. I don't know who that guy is, but he gets all his news from antiwar.com, it sounds like, and cool. What a great top-of-the-hour thing. Is that a daily thing? Is that a even, like, multiple-times-a-day thing where we can have different ones at the top of each hour for per day kind of deal? Is that how that works? Man, that's really something. I hope. I don't know, but I like it. Got to mention that. All right, now, we're going to be talking Libya and Ukraine with Jason. So, got those boxes checked here. What was I going to say about that? I don't remember. Oh, yeah. Rohrabacher. That was that. Transcripts. The lady that was doing the transcripts, she did like, I don't know, 10 awesome transcripts. And then she disappeared. But now she's back with at least one good one of Phil Giraldi. The last one about Israelis spying in America, if you want to go and take a look at that, it's up there in the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews. And I don't know what I can ever do to make it worth her while to keep this up, but those who are talented at really knocking out badass transcripts on the first try and in a hurry are very few and far between. And so I'm blessed. Her name is Joanne, and she's a great lady, real nice lady, and I sure hope that, you know, somehow it's convenient for her to keep doing this. I don't know what I could ever pay her or anything, but I don't know. I can come up with something or something. Maybe one of you guys wants to take on paying my transcriptionist. I don't know. Wouldn't that be cool? But we got a lot of great interviews on here. And, you know, a lot of them could be newsworthy if we had transcripts and direct quotes to link back to in a lot of ways. You know, get the show more attention. And get these stories more attention. After all, when somebody like Phil Giraldi says something, that can, not necessarily always, but that can be a headline. And you hear Phil Giraldi say on this show all the time, yeah, he knows people, former CIA officer. He knows people, and what they're telling him is, for example, the Saudis are bankrolling all the anti-Muslim Brotherhood protests in Egypt. And so every time there's a big anti-Muslim Brotherhood protest, and then it gets all crazy and violent, and some kook is running around like the Black Bloc setting stuff on fire and provoking a riot or whatever it is, that's the Saudi interference. He was reporting that on this show 6 months before the coup d'etat last year. For example, that could have been written up as a news story, but there was no transcript at the time. Well, here he's saying, hey, listen, every intelligence officer in America, in the counterintelligence, in the FBI, or in the CIA, or the DIA, or Navy intelligence, or whatever it is, they'll all tell you, oh, yeah, the Israelis, what they're up to here, forget about it. It's absolutely out of control, and like the VA killing an old man, there's no accountability whatsoever. On it goes, on and on and on. So, anyway, I think that's great. Thank you, Joanne, and I sure hope that we can keep this going. I mean, she was cranking them out like it was nothing, like it didn't even bother. Like, she's just sitting down and transcribing things. So, I'm very hopeful, if not quite optimistic, just because, hey, volunteer transcription has got to come and go, because that's pretty time-consuming, right? I mean, what are you going to do? It's not that big of an operation here, you understand. But anyway, if you want to go post that transcript, it's over there, scotthorton.org/interviews. Go read it. Go listen to it. Go re-quote it. All right, now, a little bit of moralizing here for a minute, since it's Memorial Day. I wanted to mention that, and it sounds stupid, I don't know the right way to say this, I ain't that smart, that's not the point of this show, I'm just interested, that's all. You understand? But it seems important to me that, it seems important to note, and it seems important that it's important to note, that, hey, foreigners are human beings, and actually you don't have the right to murder them, and actually if your government gives you a license to kill, that doesn't mean anything. And you don't have to believe in God or Jesus or any other kind of doctrine that says that you don't have the right to kill people, any kind of mystical doctrine. The truth of the matter is, under, I don't know, whatever, shrug, Lockean, Rothbardian, natural rights theory, other people own themselves and you don't have the right to take their life away. That's it. If you're stopping them in the act of aggression, that's one thing. Otherwise, that's it. And you know what really got me tripping out on this was, and you'll find this in the Viewpoints page, not actually the front page, but the Viewpoints page at antiwar.com, is an interview of our friend, Scott Horton, don't forget his name, Bromfeld. Oh my God, unforgivable lapse of thinking here. The guy from the Huffington Post, he teaches literature at Yale, and he's brilliant. Oh, Bromwich, what did I say? David Bromwich. So David Bromwich, he's an editor of literature at Yale. And whenever I talk to him on this show, I try to pay very, very close attention because he's really smart. And sometimes I thought I knew what he was saying. And then it turns out he had some real smart thing to say that I couldn't have anticipated or something. He's one of those, he's a literature professor at Yale. And he's no commie either. You know, I mean, I guess he's some kind of progressive or liberal or whatever, but he's got a very broad point of view. He edited the collected works of Edmund Burke, the godfather of conservatism. So he's a guy who knows a lot of things and understands a lot of things. And anyway, he understands a lot of things that I can't understand. And here he is in this interview. He's talking about all these authors and all these ideas that they expounded on. And we're talking about real high-level academic type philosophical sort of historical thing. And the interviewer and David Bromwich, they both know what the hell he's talking about, but I don't know what he's talking about, and I don't recognize the names of all these authors. A few of them, you know, but not mostly. But I'm getting to the point, I swear to God, which is that it's actually like a real big deal, man. In fact, he cites Edmund Burke. It was a really big deal when Edmund Burke says, wait, when we kill foreigners, we are killing people. And even though that they're strangers to us, it's possible that it might be immoral, actually, to kill them. Just as much as if we did know them and they were of us. Oh my God! This is the earth-shatteringest breakthrough ever? That Edmund Burke had to say that? Okay, fine. Take the snark out, Scott. Great. Yeah. Hey, everybody, did you know that Edmund Burke said that if somebody's from another country, they're still human? My God. And the reason I can sound so stupid and all about this is because really, I'm at least, 10% criticizing my old former self. And at my worst, I was 14 in ninth grade. And I thought that bombing the hell out of Iraq would be just great. Because I'm a boy. I've got red blood. I'm obsessed with boobs and explosions. I want to see, all my life I've seen documentaries about the awesomeness of the hardware of the American military. I want to see some bombs. And it didn't occur to me. I didn't care because I was 14. But I was wrong. Iraqis really are people, and it is wrong to murder them, it turns out. So happy Memorial Day, Iraqis, the million dead ones from the last war, 2 million dead from the last 20 years. Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's Memorial Day 2014, and we're wrapping up the show now with our old friend Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. And may I hasten to mention that it's their fun drive going on. And when you talk about bang for your buck, you can't get better than antiwar.com. Give me a break. Jason Ditz, Justin Raimondo, Kelly Vallejos, just that's all you need to know right there, right? Jason and Eric getting the news together for you from all around the world, all day, every day. I don't know what I'd do without it. And yeah, I partially benefit, but just a little. It's more about everybody else but me, the institution itself. So give them as much money as you can. Okay, thank you. So let's talk about, first of all, well, I don't know, you pick. We got an election of sorts, at least, in Ukraine. The chocolate tycoon has come out on top. And also, we've got God knows what's breaking out in Libya right now. So I guess whichever you prefer to get us caught up on, go right ahead, and I'll try to come up with some follow-up questions.
Okay, I guess let's start with Libya then. It was 8 days ago now that General Khalifa Haftar attacked Parliament with his self-proclaimed Libyan National Army. They marched into Parliament, took the building over, and announced that Parliament was dissolved. But Parliament's not really dissolved either, because they still keep meeting, just not in the building.
Right, well, and then, so, has he taken authority over the army? Has the army given him authority over them, or how's that working out? Because that's where the rubber really meets the road, or does it even matter how much of an army does he even have to command if he could command it? I don't know.
Well, there isn't much of an army in Libya. He has the support of parts of the army. The Air Force has backed him, military intelligence has backed him. The Navy is not backing him, and the chief of the Navy was narrowly survived an assassination attempt after announcing he wasn't backing him. There's some dispute as to how much of the Interior Ministry is backing him. Some say they are, some say they're not. And the real big question is how much the United States is backing him.
Yeah, well, so give us some more of that background.
Well, General Haftar, who hasn't actually been a general for almost 30 years now, got his start with Gaddafi. He helped Gaddafi take power in the 60s. He was loyal general throughout up until the Chad War when he got captured. Gaddafi pretty quickly disavowed him once his troops got captured in Chad. And he was recruited by the CIA, fairly openly and fairly common knowledge to join this National Salvation Front faction, which he was in the National Front for Salvation of Libya. The former Prime Minister, Ali Zaidan, was also a big leader in that group, which was fairly openly backed by the CIA throughout the 80s as a tool for regime change, which never really happened until 2011.
Yeah, it was amazing back in 2011. I think we talked about him specifically back then even because it was so open, and McClatchy newspapers had the story first, I think, but I don't even think they tried to really be that sneaky about it. That I think they were trying to reassure us, maybe, or reassure factions within the establishment that, don't worry, we have some guys who are going to come out on top of this. Because, you know, that Ahmed Chalabi and INC thing worked out so well in Iraq. Don't worry, we've got some exiles that we're going to put right in power there. That must have been part of the sales pitch, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And the incredible thing is, Khalifa Haftar hadn't been living in the region in decades. After the regime change in Chad, when Gaddafi's ally took power, the U.S. evacuated all of the rebels from there, and he'd been living in like Metro D.C. for the last 25 years. He was living basically a stone's throw away from Langley, Virginia, for decades.
Yeah, I think you even linked to the Google map or something, didn't you, back in 2011? Or was that Justin?
I think that was Justin.
Yeah, like, hey, look, everybody, this is how many times you would have to throw a rock before you hit CIA headquarters from this guy's front door, you know? You can count it. Like, walking paces. All right, yeah, well, good times. All right, now, so, but then the question is, well, you say he's got apparently control of parts of the army. How much of Libya did the army control before he took them over? And does it look like they're now expanding that authority, or they're still fighting to hang on to what they had before?
Well, that's kind of the thing. The Libyan army didn't control all that much of the country. A lot of it was dependent on the support of Islamist militias, which were the big players in the ouster of Gaddafi. Misrata's militia, of course, was notoriously brutal against what they saw as Gaddafi sympathizers, destroyed the whole neighboring town. And these factions are still around, and these factions are really the ones that control most of the territory in Libya. And Haftar's justification for the takeover has sort of morphed. When he first took over parliament, it was to purge parliament of Islamists.
Mm-hmm.
He made that his official stance for several days. And the State Department disavowed any knowledge of it, although conspicuously the U.S. had troops dispatched to Sicily in case they had to evacuate the embassy just 2 days before he took over. So the idea that it was a surprise to them, I don't think is very credible. But the real interesting thing is General Haftar, after the State Department disavowed him, U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Deborah Jones, gave a sort of broad foreign policy speech. It was broadcast on one of the C-SPANs, and she was very pro-Haftar, saying, oh, you know, he's so misunderstood. The media is giving him, is really misinterpreting what he's doing. He's just an anti-terrorism fighter. And since her speech, Hifter's own official stance has changed to reflect that, too. Now, instead of saying he's going to purge Parliament of Islamists, he's purging Parliament of terrorist supporters.
Mm.
And says that Parliament had turned Libya into a state sponsor of terror, and that was why he had to act.
Right. And, well, and of course that's partly true, right? I mean, this represents the Americans finally turning against the Mujahideen that they had at least accidentally in power. I think maybe they were a little bit naive about how this thing was going to work out, but not that they weren't warned by you and everybody else about who it was that they were actually fighting the war for back in 2011.
Well, right, and
Not that that would justify further intervention from my point of view, but I'm just saying it's sort of better than outright fighting on behalf of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, right?
Well, and his timing was of the takeover was just a couple of hours after a new government was voted in Parliament, a new cabinet that was backed by the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, when Zaidan was prime minister for months and months, Hifter was sort of talking about how he thought there needed to be changes in Parliament, but he sort of looked the other way. And the moment that this Prime Minister Metik takes over, he launches this coup attempt.
Right. All right, now, I already blew the break, but let me hold you here. And when we get right back, we'll pick it up right there.
Okay.
It's Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. He's the news editor there. Oh, did it again. At antiwar.com. All right, anyway, before I let Jason talk more, which is what I want to hear, I have to say this one thing real quick that I didn't get a chance to work into the rest of the show. All of the media agrees that Obama surprised the American troops in Afghanistan with a surprise visit because he loves them so much, which made it all that more special for them that they got to be surprised by their heroic leader that they all worship so much. And yet, isn't it the case that every single one of us in this country and probably everyone in the whole world knows that he has to sneak in at night unannounced because they lost the war? And they're beset by enemies. And if it was known that the heroic victor emperor was coming to see what was, you know, to check on his colony over there, they would blow him out of the sky. And they know it, and they dare not take the risk. Same with him this whole time, and George Bush this whole time, ever since at least the invasion of Iraq. That's how they've done it. And every time the media goes along and calls it a surprise, the surprise is just to make it that much better for the morale of the soldiers, rather than these heroic military conquerors are actually cowards and must sneak in the middle of the night anonymously and then spin it in some retarded thing that no sixth grader ought to be fooled by. Anyway, sorry. Jason, where we left off, we were talking about the coup, such as it is so far in Libya, and how it's come to this, and the excuses for it, and the degree of American support that I guess is still in question here. Now, do you want to pick up with that before we get to Ukraine? Does it seem to you like the Americans are committed to helping this Hifter guy see this through, or maybe they're just placing half a bet on him just in case, or what? Because like you said, there's not much of an army to rule the country with, assuming he could get everybody loyal, right? And nobody, I don't think, wants to train them all up, a new 100,000-man army that their country can never afford, et cetera, like that.
Right. It does seem like they're hedging their bets here. The ambassador spoke about him as sort of, you know, defending the country from terrorism, but the State Department officially insists he doesn't have anything to do with them. There seems to be shaping up a civil war between supporters of Parliament and supporters of him. And it really isn't clear who's going to win, so I think the U.S. is kind of playing both sides to the middle here, figuring that whenever it becomes apparent which side's going to win, that's the side they're going to say they were backing all along.
Yep. All right, now, so let's switch to Ukraine, because there's so much to cover here, and I hope most of the people are familiar with how we got into this mess, but we may not be able to cover all of that. But anyway, obviously the country is very divided. They've held this election. And now there were elections just a couple of weeks ago in the East about whether they want some degree of autonomy. And I think they left it sort of vaguely defined, where in some cases it sort of was a declaration of independence, but maybe just a declaration that they really want a lot more autonomy than they've had, but still to remain within Ukraine. But so now comes the presidential election held by the new coup government in Kiev, the American-backed government in Kiev, basically as their attempt to now legitimize their coup, basically, by having an election here. But I guess, can you first of all maybe update us on how the actual voting went? Did the people in the East even participate, or did they boycott the thing, or did they have a chance? They wanted to participate. Were they able to? That kind of thing. And then if you could tell us about the guy that everybody's saying is the landslide victor here, the chocolate king.
Yeah, well, most of the East did not vote in this. There was some voting. Some places opened. Some places didn't open. A lot of ballots never showed up. The major city in the protester held East, Donetsk. Virtually none of the city itself voted. People were being told that. When their polls didn't open, they were being told, and it's not clear by who, that the voting was going to take place at the airport. Everybody shows up at the airport. There's no ballots. There's no organization of any kind. So, for the most part, the East just plain didn't vote. Whether they wanted to or not, most of them didn't really have a choice.
All right, now, so I guess when you tell us about the guy, as much as you know about him, could you please include what the people of the East think of him? I mean, for example, Yulia Tymoshenko, the gas princess, was on the phone talking about, you know, the entire eastern half of the country as though they were all illegal aliens trespassing from Russia and this and that, which, you know, I know she came in a distant fourth or second or whatever it was, pretty distant, but she had basically, you know, renounce any pretension to authority over them with that kind of statement. But I wonder if, you know, there's a chance that maybe the people of the East, you know, sort of like this guy, maybe they could see him as a compromise type of a candidate and give everybody an out here rather than go further down the path toward more of a full-scale civil war. Already, you know, scores have been killed, of course.
Well, he definitely could be a compromise candidate. Here, Petro Poroshenko, the chocolate king, he's a billionaire by a fair bit, mostly chocolate, as you'd imagine from his name. He also owns a couple of news stations in Ukraine, but where he stands is sort of unclear right now, because for somebody that's been in politics pretty much nonstop since 2004, he's just constantly changed parties to back whoever happens to be in power or is about to take power at any given time. He was holding key positions in the last elected government up until about a year before the ouster by the Maidan protesters. It was starting to become apparent that that government was losing support. He was one of the first ones to jump on the protest bandwagon to oust that government, and now here he is as the replacement for that government. And he was in the Tymoshenko government before that, so he's really sort of the consummate politician, being able to read what direction the country's going and jumping on the bandwagon.
All right, now, well, I don't know if it's even conceivable that the Kiev government will be able to consolidate control over the East, and things could get much worse before, you know, that could be accomplished, you know, on their part. But what about, you know, going forward from here? Has this guy made it clear exactly what his position is on these sort of all-or-nothing trade deals with the EU, with Russia, with the International Monetary Fund, and whether he's willing to try to liquidate all the last assets in the country to transfer all the wealth out, or what the hell he's doing. they tried to do it their way before, and it's completely blown up in their face here, right? So I just wonder whether, you know, well, maybe a better way to put it, are the Americans conceding, are they telling this guy, go ahead and compromise, rather than, you know, sticking with our, you know, former demands, which is you can have a deal with us, but not with the Russians?
Well, we're sort of getting mixed signals out of that. He's given some lip service, at least, to compromise and to making deals with Russia. He's got some pretty significant business interests in Russia that would certainly make it awfully difficult for him to be the harsh anti-Russian that Turchinov was. And at the same time, those protesters that ousted the last elected government in Kiev, the Maidan protesters, are still there. They didn't go anywhere. Even after they ousted that government, all these, you know, ultra-nationalist factions, the right sector, they're all still there, and they're all demanding extremely harsh measures be taken against the East to ensure the country's territorial integrity. So he's got to sort of find a way to, if he does want to make a compromise, do it without alienating the protesters.
Yeah. Well, and that it has this same situation in common with Libya where, you know, just thank goodness that all these different factions are so weak that nobody's going to really be able to kill hundreds of thousands, probably. They're going to have to figure out some kind of other solution because nobody really has the ability to wage full-scale mechanized warfare, you know?
Oh, right. The Ukrainian military is really a joke at this point. It's mostly still just Soviet equipment, and not even the good Soviet equipment, because Russia kept most of that. So it's a lot of the gear from the Soviet Union circa the 1960s. Most of it's in disrepair. Very little works. You know, even Jeeps and things like that they had, a lot of them have, you know, the battery is dead, half the tires are flat. When they withdrew from Crimea, there was sort of a 2 or 3 day period between when Russia gave them a deadline to be out of Crimea because the annexation had already taken place and when they actually got out. And it wasn't so much that they were resisting giving up that territory, it's that their vehicles and whatnot flat out wouldn't start. And one of the governors from the western part of Ukraine had to loan them some money so that they could buy gasoline for their trucks and new batteries and move these vehicles out of the area.
Yeah. You know, I read this thing. It was very biased against them, too, by Yulia, whatever is her name, writing in the New Republic about the grandma warriors. And this is just the most brilliant tactic of warfare. Even if you take at face value the way she describes it, that these raw, just vicious old ladies or whatever her spin is, that when the armored personnel carriers come into town, they are the front. And she calls them shock troops, the grandma shock troops. But what they do is they run up unarmed to the APC and dare these young men to massacre them. And the young men in the APC say, no. And then all of a sudden, and this is the part where she may be taking liberties, I don't know, but it sounds like a good tactic anyway. Then all of a sudden, up rush some locals with rifles and disarm them. And another victory for the Grandma Brigade. Not a shot fired, another detachment disarmed and defanged. So, it's a hell of a story anyway. I don't know if you saw that one, but
it is, and I've actually seen some footage of Easterners confronting the military coming in, and that's not that far off from what's happening, at least the first part. I mean, you never really see the guys with rifles coming out to disarm them. You see little old ladies and sometimes little old men along with them coming up and confronting these armored personnel carriers, and, you know, sometimes there's troop commander that's in the armored personnel carrier, you'll see a little old lady slap him in the face or something and tell him they're not welcome here and tell him to hand over their guns. And for the most part, these troops, you know, they're poorly paid troops not willing to attack their own people, which is, of course, a blessing here.
Right. By the way, let me ask you about this, as long as we're over time, but I'll let you go in just a sec. But all this controversy, I don't really care, but there's a big controversy over, well, I guess it kind of matters just because it shows the honesty or not of the way the Russians are dealing in this. They have said that they're pulling the troops back from the border, and then perhaps in different circumstances they're recalling their troops to their bases or something. And all along, they've been saying this for weeks. And all along, the Westerners and the head of NATO and American politicians and others have said they haven't seen a shred of evidence that the Russians are pulling back from the border, et cetera, et cetera. And so you know how they are. You just can't believe a word they say about anything. Maybe that's right, but I just wonder whether you could help fill in some of the gaps there.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is there's not this conspicuous military presence at the border to begin with. The fact that Russia is doing training operations somewhat near the Ukrainian border, it was seen as a provocative action on paper, but we had NBC News did a great job when this first started being a story of sending some people actually to that border, crossing the Ukraine-Russia border, taking pictures, and you don't see troops there by and large. There were some tanks, a lot of trucks. If you look hard enough, you could find them because they were taking part in military exercises a few miles off the border. But the fact that there wasn't this big, obvious invasion force massing at the Ukrainian border in the first place means that it's not that obvious when they're withdrawing.
Right. Makes a great talking point, though, to spin.
Right, and Russia's sort of been, not very clear about their intentions with when they're going to withdraw that training force. Some have said it's going to happen in a few weeks. Some have said it's already starting to happen. Ukraine's border patrols have said they've seen some signs of movement away from the border, but they can't tell how much. And a lot of it just seems like it's not very well organized at all, and it's not clear what they're doing.
Right. All right, well, we're already over time, so I'll let you go. But thank you very much for your time, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Talk to you again. All right, but that's the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. And you know what? Honestly, out of everything that there is on the internet, if you got limited time, you want to keep up, news.antiwar.com. That's what you need to know the most. And Jason is really on top of it for you. That's news.antiwar.com. And this week especially, antiwar.com/donate as well. And that's it for the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you tomorrow.